Bong, or even bong, dong the bowl. That's right. Okay, let's look a little in this weekend of consolidation at this process of relating to the Awen. And in a way, I want to look a little bit at what Awen is and how it lives in our life. And partly to do that, I want to look a little bit about the tradition of the Awenithion. We think of them now as bards. But the older word Awenithion is a more interesting word in some ways, because to be an Awenithion is the word, it means somebody who is at the service of Awen.
Can you spell that so I can...
Awen, Y-double-D, so Awenith.
Yeah.
I-O-N.
Right.
Awenithion, it would mean the person or people, the people who are the servants of the Awen, the servants of this mysterious thing. And the poem Prithianun, in a way, is a sort of a manual, a poetic manual for connecting with Awen. Now we have this account by Gerald of Wales, Gerald the Welshman, Geraldus Cambrensensis, as he's kind of written academic works, who writes about his journey through Wales in the Middle Ages. And there's a place where he talks about the Awenithion as these people who, he describes them as if they're insane people, basically. And he's, and with Gerald, he's writing in a way for he's writing an amusing work for his overlords. He's a Norman writer. He's Welsh, but he's writing. You know, he's writing to that Norman world about the eccentricities and the oddness of the Welsh. And he describes these people who twitch and fall about and go into trances and speak in strange, incomprehensible words. And then he says something very interesting, which he's obviously got from talking to the Awenithion of his time, where they sometimes feel as though their lips and mouth are smeared with milk and honey. There is a sweetness. Or sometimes they feel that a piece of paper is pressed into their mouth with words upon it, and they speak the words. Now, what's being described there is writing it up in a slightly Monty Python-esque kind of way, because he's slightly poking fun at something he doesn't quite understand. But what's being described is that process of the body bridging into the mysterious place, and people then the Awenithion bringing back from that place strange words or sensations or images. And as he tries to talk to the Awenithion about what's happening to them, they use this kind of a quasi-biblical kind of language. You know, it's like the milk and honey. You find references to milk and honey in the land of, you know, going to Canaan, going to the promised land, the land of milk and honey. Or you'll get references sometimes in sort of early Christian literature to the milk and honey of paradise. And the Welsh word for paradise is gwenfro. Again, we get this word, this syllable wen, which is at the heart of the word awen. So paradise, in a sense, is the place of where the awen lives. It is the dwelling place of awen. It is also the place of profound nourishment. So the milk and the honey, you're talking about the wonderful desserts, right? It's that kind of image of the... And you get this image, there's a lot in Welsh tradition and in Arthurian tradition. The Grail gives everybody the food they most need to eat. So that it's profoundly nourishing, it brings in this... And sometimes quite exotic, this kind of milk and honey of paradise. Or you sometimes hear when they talk about the Grail, all the spices of Araby come in, the smell of all the spices of Araby come into the room. So this sense of this place outside the world, or touching something that is exotic, powerful, mysterious, and that beautifies the world. Now the Awenyddion are part of this kind of movement in sort of Middle Ages that produces the poems of Taliesin and the Mabinogion. Now why they're interesting is because the Mabinogion, though it looks like it's a book now, I mean it's published as a book, probably was written in its finished form over about 200 years, something like that. And it kept getting collected. Now, what we have is the Mabinogion are two manuscripts, the White Book of Rhydderch, the Red Book of Hergest, which are collections, which are manuscript collections. So that we also have the Book of Taliesin, which is another collection. And because of our kind of more linear way of thinking, we're liable to think of, okay, that's a thing, but it's not a thing, it's a process. Poems of Taliesin are a process. They're things of but they're a process of collecting something important together at a time when that thing that's being collected is under enormous threat. And what's interesting about the Mabinogion, what's interesting about the poems of Taliesin, is that while they draw on ancient roots, they are, for their time, completely contemporary. So the stories are told in are written down in medieval times, and the characters in the story are described as contemporary characters. So we're not learning about the ancient tribal gods of the Welsh. We're learning about these powerful, magical people. Now one of the things the Awenyddion do in particular is they invent a new goddess, or they find a new goddess. The goddess Ceridwen, you won't find her anywhere before that kind of that medieval period. You know, there's no references to her in mythology. And what that tradition arises out of is a fusion of ancient tribal Celtic tradition with Christian tradition. As I was saying yesterday, there are two edges to that. Partly, sometimes they use Christian tradition as a way of masking their more heretical beliefs. But they didn't just do that. What they did was to work with the kind of because they're working with the field of the imaginal world that they're in, which is a fusion of old tradition and the images and the stories that come out of the Bible and the New Testament. So one of the great figures of Middle Age tradition is of course Mary, Mother of Jesus, and the cult of Mary is a very very strongly connected with the Arthurian stories, strongly connected with the cult of the Grail, and what the bards do, what the Awenyddion do, is they want a sort of Mary of their own, who has connections, who has deeper connections for them than the Catholic Mary. And Ceridwen is a kind of Mary. This is this mother who gives birth to a son who has a tragic fate and whom she will do anything to heal. So this image of the mother and the child. It's also based on very ancient Celtic images of Modrum and of the mother and the son, Modrum, Mabon and Modrum. Mabon is very ancient, Maponus, very ancient Celtic god. And the mother, the image of the Great Mother, is central to Celtic tradition. So, but what you see happening there in the image of Ceridwen is a fusion of an ancient world with a contemporary world. What, and even when we look at the story of Taliesin, what happens to Ceridwen is that there is this mysterious little boy, Gwion, who in a way steals the birthright of Mavran, as her true son, and whom she then pursues through the universe. She in a sense destroys him by eating him and gives birth to him again. Now, she's such an interesting figure, Ceridwen, because she combines that in that image of Mary, the loving mother who responds to the flow of the universe, that loves her son, with some of the characteristics of the Morrigan, of the great battle queen of the Celts. Because she is also this terrible, fierce figure that pursues the child, eats him, destroys. She's also the devouring mother, but then she is profoundly creative, so she recreates things. And so from that point of view, she is the embodiment of the spirit of the Awen, that the energy that creates and destroys, because the impact of the new destroys the old. There's a wonderful book by a guy called Anton Ewschwig, who is a fairly early psychoanalyst, called The Hidden Order of Art. And he it's an amazing book, because he looks at how genuinely creative new developments in art are experienced initially as really destructive, because they disrupt the known order. He talks in particular how Beethoven's work was absolutely hated when it came out, universally hated, just regarded not as music. Very hard for us even to imagine that. I mean, Beethoven's so much a staple of our, of high, if you like, musical, classical musical culture. And it was loathed when it came out. And Anton Ewschwig does this thing where he says, well, and it's a very interesting book if you're interested in looking into artistic movements and creativity, because he pulls out example after example of people who are now staples of the Western canon, who are regarded as appalling and created riots sometimes. Stravinsky's work, for example, was incredibly controversial, and people protesting against it and regarding it as vile. So in a way, this is this kind of quality, really, that the Awen disrupts. You know, it disrupts and it creates, it kills and it makes alive. And so, in a way, one of the problems, in a sense, with the image of Mary and the conventional image of Jesus is that these are profoundly conservative images. There is no dynamism inside them, right? So they're intended to reinforce the status quo. Now, one of the reasons that the figure of Mary becomes such a big figure in the medieval Catholic Church was the Church wanted people to obey, and Mary is the image of obedience. I am the handmaiden of the Lord, made be unto me according to thy will. Now, in terms of the Catholic Church, the will of the divine comes through the magisterium of the Church. So to use an image of total obedience and to develop the cult of Mary as a way of reinforcing the power of the magisterium is, of course, very important. And the subversive thing, the interesting thing that the bards do, they do two interesting things. One, they reinterpret Welsh tradition, but they also reinterpret Christian tradition. And it's profoundly interesting and profoundly surreal. And actually, because they what they're doing is relating to the images of their time. And you will find they will write poems about Mary that are actually about their Mary. They will write about Jesus. And Jesus is not gentle Jesus, meek and mild, the man who's, but who is the Jesus our Druid. So they are taking the images, they're taking the kind of images of oppression in some way and flipping them over. Because what they're really interested in is this place of connectedness, this place of getting present, and this mysterious energy called the Awen coming in and disrupting things and recreating things. You find it a lot in the last bit of the Prithayanun poem, that they really show. Where's it gone? You know, this place where they say, monks howl like a choir of dogs from a contest with those who know. Does the wind have one track? Is the sea one water? Is fire one fierce, invincible spark? Monks crowd together like wolves from a contest with men who know. They know not the divisions of midnight and dawn, unknowing of the wind's course. What is the gale's force? Where does it ravage? What land does it strike? The saint's grave lies hidden deep in the ground. I praise the sovereign, the great high prince. May sadness leave me. Christ is my protector. Now what they're doing there in those few lines is really challenging the church. They're challenging the priests. They're challenging the Lord's bookmen. They're challenging the monks. Because saying we are those who know, and what we know is Awen, we know, which is like wind, is like water, is like fire, and it is one thing and it is many things. We know about time. We know the divisions of midnight and dawn. We know where the wind is blowing. Where is the wind blowing at the moment? Where's the wind blowing inside you? Where's it blowing inside the world? We know where it ravages. What does it destroy? We know what land it strikes. And then we come to this place. The saint's grave lies hidden deep in the ground. Now, one of the legendary histories of Taliesin has his father as Saint Henog. So Taliesin, in a certain sense, is the son of a saint. Henog, the word hen means old. So he is the son of the old saint. And if we trace the genealogy back in certain of the Welsh traditions, he is a descendant of Bran the Blessed, who himself is the son of Hlir, the great son of the sea. So what they're doing there is saying that that Taliesin, who is the root of Bardic tradition, is the son of the old saint, and in saying that Christ is my protector, they're laying claim to a certain understanding of Christian tradition, and they're suggesting that the bards know a deeper form of Christianity. A more mysterious form of Christianity, a more ancient form, you'll find this coming up time and time again in Druidic tradition as it reemerges in the 18th century, where they talk about the Druids working with a primitive form or an archetypal form of Christianity. And that's because what the Awenyddion, what the bards are doing is saying, within the teachings, even within your teachings, the teachings of the church, there are things you do not understand. Because you do not understand the mysterious aspect of the Awen. And there are things here that we understand because and Christ protects us, the true Christ, the who understands and who stands with those who know, not with the monks. Not with the monks who are howling like a choir of dog and crowding together like wolves. Now, the other place where we see some of this is in some of the poems of Taliesin, in the Mabinogi of Taliesin that we find in the Mabinogion. Now, this again is a constructed story, definitely a Middle Ages story, because and drawn from various traditions about the poems, the Taliesin poems, and the things like the Prothaenon come first, and then later on the story of Taliesin gets told as a Mabinogi, as the story of the youthful adventures of Taliesin. It's a later work than the four branches of the Mabinogi, and is likely influenced or created because the four branches are only in existence. But it's collecting some very old traditions. And what we hear Taliesin saying about himself, he's asked, "Who are you?" "Primary chief bard am I to Elfin, and my original country is the region of the summer stars. Idno and Hainin called me Mavithin, Merlin. At length every king will call me Taliesin. I was with my lord in the highest sphere on the fall of Lucifer into the depth of hell. I have borne a banner before Alexander. I know the names of the stars from north to south. I have been in the galaxy at the throne of the distributor. I was in Canaan when Absalom was slain. I conveyed the Awen to the Vale of Hebron. I was in the court of Don before the birth of Gwydion. I was instructor to Eli and Enoch. I am the winged genius of the splendid cross. I have been loquacious prior to being gifted with speech. I was at the place of the crucifixion of the merciful Mabon. I have been three periods in the prison of Arianrod. I have been chief director of the Tower of Nimrod. I am a wonder whose origin is not known. I was in Asia with Noah in the ark. I have seen the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. I have been in India when Rome was built. I am come here now to the remnants of Troy. I have been with my Lord in the manger of the ass. I strengthened Moses through the water of the Jordan. I have been in the firmament with Mary Magdalene. I obtained the muse from the cauldron of Ceridwen. I have been bard of the harp to Cleon of Lochlin. I have been on the White Hill in the court of Cavanlen. For a year and a day, and in stocks and fetters, I have suffered hunger for the Son of the Virgin. I have been fostered in the land of the Deity. I am teacher to all intelligences. I am able to instruct the whole universe. I shall be here until the day of doom on the face of the earth, and it is not known with my body is flesh or fish. I was for 9 months in the womb of the hag Ceridwen. I was originally little Gwion. At length I am Taliesin." So you can see in this poem this fusion of Welsh traditions, biblical traditions. And in a way this is Taliesin speaking as the spirit of the Awen, as the connector between what was and what is, and what may be. And in a way, the place where the poem leads us to at the end is it leads us right into this place of relationship with the Awen, a relationship, because these things were, the monks are inside us. Just as Taliesin is inside us, just as the Awen is inside us, so the places inside us where we turn upon the mysterious kind of knowing. Now we go right back to the beginning of this poem, because the poem's circular really, because you come back right at the end to the praising the sovereign, the great high prince, wanting sadness to leave you and Christ is your protector. We begin by praising the sovereign, the great high prince. who encompasses the margins of the world. And then we're immediately into relationship with the prisoner, the place of sadness, the place that is locked up. So the poem loops round on itself. And it's partly kind of indicating this spiral kind of movement. And it ends by inviting us to link with the saint's grave, which is this mysterious place that links us somewhere simultaneously with the ancient traditions of Christianity and the Bible, and the place of Brown the Blessed and the ancient Welsh traditions. So it simultaneously is saying, okay, look at Jesus, look at Mary, look at all the figures of the Bible that have been so influential in the development of the West, and here are these other traditions that are underground alongside them, older, and somehow they're both important. And who is Christ? Right, so Christ is our protector. In the Bible, the moment when Jesus becomes Christ is the moment of baptism in the Jordan, where the Spirit descends upon him, where you could say the breath of the Awen comes in. And you've got this very powerful kind of moment where he's in the middle of the river. And you've got John the Baptist sort of plunging him into the waters and then this image of the heaven of, so he goes down into the depth, and then the height opens up and then this mysterious bird descends. So when we were looking yesterday at the business of going down into the depths and coming up, so as he comes up from the depths, then the bird comes down. This is a really similar process to the process that we were looking at yesterday of the going down into the cauldron, but also then the light coming down from above and standing in the middle of the flow of things between the two banks. Now, classically, the River Jordan is the border place of Israel, the border place, if you like, of the Promised Land and the Unholy Land. And then, God knows, it's still politically a nightmarish kind of place. The Jordan crossing holds for us all kinds of tensions and difficulties in the Middle East. But in that kind of biblical time, it is the edge of the Holy Land and the land that is not holy. So the very place where the Christ is born is in the middle of the river, in the middle between the depth and the height, being plunged into the waters by the prophet John, who is about to have his head cut off. So the living, who is in a sense really the man who brings the waters of life, who is himself about to die. So you have all these kind of opposites constellated at that place. Now that place is the same place. So Christ is our protector. It is, what is meant by that is the protector is, the word Christ or Christos means anointed one. So what we hear Christ saying of himself in the Bible, I am the firstborn of many brethren. I am not the Savior. Christ never talks about himself as the Savior. Paul does this later on. And one of the things he says in his farewell discourses, I have to vanish so that the Holy Spirit can come. So that in a sense, so my image has to go away from you, because he's this being who goes through death and the experience of resurrection. But the last bit of his story is he says, I have to leave you. I have to ascend to my Father or wherever. But I have to leave you so that the Holy Spirit can come. And the Spirit appears like a rushing wind or like a flame. But I have to go away. My image, my being, my sense of who I am has to vanish so that the divine breath can come in. Now for the bards, so as you're sitting there as an Awenioth, that bit of the story they read quite straightforwardly, as of course you know, because the Awen is more fundamental, than any god form or god image. Out of the breath of the Awen, god forms and images emerge. You know, so that image of the Awen is these three rays and three drops that come out of the, and we've got this contained place that is kind of like the cauldron, or the, or actually it's three spheres of the universe. So the Awen arises out of the universe. And from the Awen, from that mysterious breath, forms appear, we appear, but gods, goddesses, all kinds of shapes appear. But the Awen is the deeper place. It is the mysterious place. And as we align ourselves with that, we become, in a certain sense, anointed by this protective energy that keeps, like Caridwen, is this energy of destruction and creation. Now, Caridwen herself is interesting, right? Because the word Carid means crooked. Wen means holy, so she could be the crooked holy woman. But there's also a relationship to the Welsh word cariad, which means beloved. So she could be the beloved crooked holy one. And the image of crookedness and holiness and sort of, and so it's a slightly sinister image. A crooked woman is like the bent witch. So it's like the bent witch who is holy and beloved. Very complicated image. You know, I would conjure up images in the medieval times of the Hag of Endor, who was a sort of, and there's all these instructions in the Bible about the awfulness of witches, which is where later persecutions and things come from. So we find in the image of Caridwen, who is the woman who nurtures the spirit of the Awen. If Taliesin, who is a sort of Jesus figure, is nurtured by the woman who is holy and crooked, destroying and creative, but beloved. Now, what's this all mean for us? The point about these stories, the point about the poem, is it trying to show us something about what happens when we get present in ourselves, when we perform this act of bridging? And let that presence of the Awen come through into our body and into our relationships. Now, what the poem says it will do, says, if we just lightly touch the poem for a moment, it somehow brings us right at the beginning into connection with an idea of sovereignty and this idea of encompassing the margins of the world. It connects us up with the center of the universe and the sense of the whole, of the world, of the margins of our world. Sometimes the margins of our world are quite small, sometimes they feel very big. But again, these are not fixed points, but they are indications. And then immediately we're into this image of the prisoner and going with Arthur into this mysterious place called Anuvin to find the cauldron of inspiration and free the prisoner. Now, in a way, if you're an Awenithion, a training Awenithion, this is so you get, okay, what I need to do is I need to align with the universe, align with the center of things, encompass the margins of my world, and then I have to perform a work of freeing the prisoner and finding the cauldron of inspiration if I'm going to be an effective Awenithion. Now we get this very powerful image of the poet's prayer shall sound forever. So we have the song of the prisoner that is somewhere linked with the constant prayer of the poet. So one of the things that's there right at the beginning is that place where we were looking at yesterday about that calling out for help of the universe. So we have the song of the prisoner rising out, calling for help inside us. But we also have this place where the poet prays. So the power of praying to something, to whatever we feel is bigger. It could be Karina. If you were a bard, it would be Caridwen. If you were an Awenniodd, you would pray that Caridwen. You would pray to Caridwen and to Taliesin, because these would be your kind of god figures. And that prayer would probably involve Jesus and Mary as well, because these would be the god figures in your imaginal kind of world. So but your understanding of who Jesus and Mary are would be influenced by your understanding of Taliesin and Caridwen. So part of your imaginal world probably would be Saint Henoch as well. And beyond that, there might be Brown the Blessed, right? So you would have this kind of, if you like, archetypal genealogy of beings that you would be inviting to kind of help you. But above all, and beyond any of the concrete images, you'd be asking the spirit of the Awen to come to you and to feed you with the milk and the honey of paradise, so that you can have the courage and the power to go into the deep places, to free the prisoner and find the cauldron. Now what the poem then goes on to do is to try and help it's a mnemonic to help the Awenniddion to remember what happens to you when you start to do this. So the song is heard in Caer Pedevran, four times revolving. Now Pedevran is the four square moving castle. Later on in the Grey Legends you get this the square castle that's turning round and round. It's hard to get into. Now, but what the deeper meaning of it in this poem is, as you come into this inner place, as you start to follow the song of the prisoner, follow the quest for the cauldron, you come into a sense of structure that's all a dynamic structure, shapes and forms that are moving. So Caer Pedevran is the square, you know, a square is a very solid place, but it gives us that image, a turning castle, so it's this image of squaring the circle. So you've got the square and the circle combining together, and it's hinting at that spiral kind of movement, four times revolving. And then it says, my original song, which is the song that we're following, stems from the cauldron. Now this is the song of the Awen. So that place, literally that place, when we go inside, we hear that song. And what it's saying is, this song stems from the cauldron kindled by the breath of nine maidens. Now what the Awenniddion would do is reflect upon that, reflect on where is the cauldron and who are the nine maidens. There's an obvious image, you know, related image of the nine muses, classical image that would have been around. But also you have in Celtic tradition the number nine is a very potent figure, because it is 3 times 3. Now the key number for the Celts is always triads, the one thing, the opposite thing, and then the reconciling thing that moves things on. So 3 to the power of 3, it takes you right into the heart of that image of the Awen, the three rays of the Awen. But it's like it's trying to say there, this is the Awen of the Awen. So the nine maidens are this is the root of the root, the power of the power. And this image of it kindling, so there's something about the kindling of the breath of the Awen. And what that image hints at is, as we go inside, as we let the song lead us to the this mysterious place called the cauldron, which contains the song of the Awen, we touch this image of kindling that comes from 3 times 3. And the maidens are these kind of, this image of the maiden's breath, it's very subtle. So the cauldron is being breathed upon, and it's the kindling of its deep inner fire comes from the breath of the nine maidens. Now this would be a, this is a sort of a contemplation image, right, where you would pray over it, you would meditate over it, you would imagine it, maybe you would draw it, you know, and you'd get interested in the kindling. What is the kindling? How do I feel when something, when, you know, when you blow on them, I mean, kindling, you blow, you know, you feel this, the image is to blow it on something, to bring something alight. You know, when you're lighting, say, a charcoal disc, which I periodically do, you breathe on it, and you have to keep breathing, and it starts off little, and it gets redder and redder, and then the whole thing, then there's a critical point where the charcoal disc becomes self-sustaining, and it and something then starts going. I'm not, you know, I've had this one famous occasion I did this, is one of the carpets in the middle of the room. The bloody thing blew up and exploded, and red or bits of charcoal came and melted pieces of the carpet. Because the process then has its own energy. Right? And in a way, that's what's being hinted at. Yeah, there you breathe on it, and then the awen turns into life, turns into fire. Goes beyond the contained place, and then you're having to kind of be carried with it. And it, and as it does that, it then tells us of the pen Anuvin, the chief of Anuvin's cauldron. What is its power? Ridged with enamel, rimmed with pearl, it will not boil the coward's portion. It is not destined. Because then it suddenly says, okay, if you're going to be the possessor of the cauldron, you're going to connect to the deep, to the origin of Anuvin, which is the origin of the deeper place. And you have to be quite brave to do that, because this is this mysterious, powerful kind of process. Now, enamel is this, the enameling is this, still is this incredibly beautiful kind of art. And often when things are enameled, they become lustrous. Pearls are the same. These images of pearls are of the beautification. So you have this deep, dark place, but then you have these beautiful, this enamel of the, so this sense of extraordinary color. And the pearls, of course, in that pagan Christian world, you can't look at a pearl without thinking of the pearl of great price, that this comes out of the biblical story, that is found in the deep places of the sea. And if you find the magical pearl, this is the pearl of great price, that if you give everything of yourself, the pearl is worth giving everything for, and it comes out of the deep. So the image is, again, that the writer of the poem is using a combination of Christian and pagan imagery to try and suggest something that's actually very extraordinary. It's saying, actually, because actually, you know, you have what here is the pearl of great price. What here is the extraordinary beauty of colour. And enamelling was this mysterious art. Right? It still is quite mysterious, quite hard to do. But then, very, very mysterious. So this magical art that enamels and that makes everything beautiful. And to do that, to stay with that is difficult. And because you participate in a mystery somewhere that could take everything that you know away from you. And it wouldn't matter, because actually what would be what you're left with is the extraordinary beauty, and the pearl of great price, and this energy that will reshape the world. And what it goes on to do is then gives us this other image, this image of the sword of Chewach, the sword which is the sword of which is wielded by the hand of Chaminag the leaper. So out of that cauldron, out of that deep place, comes the sword of light that frees the prisoner, and you become in that moment the one who leaps over obstacles. So your identity changes. You become both, in a way, the figure you become, if you're Awenyddion here, is you are the possessor of the cauldron and the wielder of the sword of light. And then immediately it plunges us into an image of before hell's gates lights are burning. So suddenly we go to hell. You know, so suddenly from when this beautiful, powerful place, suddenly at the gate of hell. we're in the place that the, or the gate to the underworld, the place of the of disturbance, death, eternal punishment. But in the older traditions, the gateway to the ancestors. But the thing is, if we simply interpret it in the older way, and that, which is comforting and kind of interesting, we go to the dead. But also they do mean Afarn. It's Afarn, the hell's gate. So it somewhere challenges us. I mean, this is the surrealism of these poems, where suddenly we have to deal with the gate to the ancestors that could simultaneously be the gate to hell. Where does that image of the gateway to hell live inside ourselves? The thing is, you see, and why we can't avoid Christianity in this work is because I'm not saying we have to become Christian, but you can't avoid what Jung discovered, what everybody discovers when you do this kind of work. You have to deal with the images that have been potent in the culture and that therefore live inside us, even though we may be really secular people that may not even know nothing about Christianity. Coded in to our culture are these ancient images of hell, of God, of Jesus, and to, as we do this work, we will encounter them in one shape or other. Now, the image of hell, it holds within it the idea of the damned and the unredeemable. So what the poet is inviting us to consider there, having been with the depth of the hour in this been with this power of beauty and glory, is then suddenly we bring light to the gates of hell. To the place, hell is this image of this kind of secret place of damnation. And for sure is one of the places where the prisoner is found. But it takes us right into the ideas of shame, of the irredeemable, of the image of lakes of fire, even Dante's whole vision of terribleness and things locked and this terrible great image that you have in Dante of the end of the devil being this frozen being at the bottom of everything. So the invitation to bring light to the gates of hell is to encounter those places in ourselves and in the world that have got so split off and so frozen that they're no longer in the flow of the Awen. And obviously that's a big thing to do, because the next line we get helped a bit, because when Gan Arthur, when with Arthur we went to the harrowing. Now, again, this is the thing that is immediately said, look, hang on a minute, you don't have to do this on your own. Remember, you are in Prudwin, you are in the ship of Arthur, you are in the company of others who are pursuing this work. This is a collective work. It's personal and collective. And the harrowing of hell, it's this image of the opening up. Harrowing, of course, is what a plough does, and a plough opens the ground, breaks it open so that new life, new seeds can come into it. So the harrowing of hell, this is something, again, in Christian tradition that Christ does. After his death, he descends into hell. So he dies on the cross, descends into hell, and brings out the trapped souls from hell. He opens up the sealed, irredeemable place and brings Adam and Eve and the ancient dead out of the frozen hellish place, out of the fires, back into the flow of things. So what is being said there is that if you're going to be an Awenithion, this is what you do. You will, with Arthur, you will harrow hell. And then it comes to the line, except seven none rose up from Carveddwyd. It reminds us that process of harrowing, that process of descent, means that we lose things. Things get lost. But seven return. And Carveddwyd is the place of the hallows. So you are, even though you're harrowing hell, you're somewhere still in the presence of the holy things, of the beautiful things. And then the poem goes on to look at these various castles. So then it's helping us explore the processes that happen to us when we do this. It looks at the process of opposites. In the foursquare court in the island of the flaming door, fresh water and jet are mixed. Bright wine is the drink served to the host. So it's saying in this process, what happens is that opposites come together. We mix water and jet. Now jet is deep, black, solid material. Bright water, fresh water. There's almost no point in doing that. Why would you do that? Water doesn't affect jet. Jet doesn't affect water. So again, it's a sort of puzzle, a conundrum. In the foursquare fort in the island of the flaming door. Right, so it gives us an image. The foursquare fort is again this mysterious turning place, this mysterious castle, but we're in the island of the flaming door. Now, one of the things you get a lot in Welsh tradition is the bards wandering, looking for the strong door. It's the doorway into the depths. It's the doorway into the places of inspiration. Sometimes you could call it the doorway of flame, because you have to pass through fire in order to reach the deeper place. So to reach the place where the hallows are found. And when you're there, you do this weird thing. You mix water and jet. You mix two things that feel like they have nothing to do with each other, and how can they possibly affect each other? Except that in medieval tradition, they believed if you did mix jet and fresh water, and they could never have done this, but they were great theoreticians in medieval, they felt that if you put water and jet together, there would be an explosive reaction. So one of the things that you could understand by this is if you put two apparently inert things that have nothing to do with each other in these particular conditions in which involve being in the place of the awen, even two things that appear to have no relationship with each other will create an explosive alchemical reaction and create something new. That's one of the ways you could understand that. What they also say is bright wine is the drink served to the host. So they conjure up this otherworldly feast of joy. When they didn't feel you're in hell, you've done this. But they're also, again, the poet suddenly brings in this image of this is a joyous feast. And you're in Caerigor, which can either mean the castle of the king, so it could be called the castle of the royal feast or the mead feast. It could also be the castle of coldness and rigidity. So again, we've got these opposites. Could be the cold castle, could be the rigid castle, could be the castle of the king. So again, you're not given answers, you're given questions, you're given opposites. And that's so like what happens when we work with these inner things. When you work with the Awen, very often you get a question like, how do things reflect? How do things reflect each other? It's not that we have to follow these particular questions. They're trying to say these are the sort of things that will happen to you. And the point of the poem, a bit like Maria's poems, they summarize, right? And they summarize a process and remind us of a process so we can use the poems to kind of reflect on what's happening. The next thing that we get into is the beginning of the sequence. I give no reward to the Lord's bookmen, who beyond Caerwydri saw not Arthur's valour, who can't see what is going on. Now Caerwydri is this image of looking into the deep places of the sea. Widro means glass, but the kind of glass they would have been talking about is this bluey, greeny kind of not easy to see through glass. That actually in the poetic tradition is seen as looking into the deep places of the sea. And that's simultaneously a bit like looking deeply down into the pool of the ancestors, because the line of the Awen Iddion goes back from Taliesin to Henog to Bran the Blessed, to who is the son of Clear, the son of the sea. So somewhere they're saying that as you look there and as you see what Arthur's doing, simultaneously you will look into all the generations before him, even back to Clear, who is the primal Celtic sea god. Later immortalized as King Lear by Shakespeare, of course. And The other thing that the poem reminds us of is that we will also encounter Cavgoli, the place where we get stopped by the sentinel who won't talk to us and the 6,000 men. So it's like you have to keep looking into the sea, keep connecting, and then you have to find a way to parley with the sentinel, to relate to the energy that is blocking you. And to find, not by knocking the wall over, you have to find a way of relating to the energy that stops you, to enable to persuade the sentinel to let you pass. And as you do that, you then come into this last part of the poem, where we're really where it really starts to take us into a more universal place. And again, I give no reward to the clerics for trailing shields who knew not who created who. Now we're right at the heart of the Awen here. Who created who? So we come right into that. Nor the hour when the chick was born. Who made him? So this image of the hatching egg. That's a little joke here, but who, you know, chicken and egg. Who made the chick? Who made the egg? Who made him? Why did he not go to the meadows of Dovwy, wherever the places that we go and don't go? They know not who's the brindled ox. Now the ox is this great kind of being that moves the stars. So who turns the wheel of the stars. Well, we went with Arthur, again we remind you, we are doing this with Arthur on an arduous visit, which is certainly feeling arduous at this point, you've gone through all these different processes. But you're in this place with the great ox that turns the wheel of the stars around. So that the, whatever you're doing is somewhere related to that great figure. And then finally, we come again to the, I give no reward to the clerics of weak intent. So again, what's hinted at there is this image of intent and mysterious will. They know not on what day the chief is made. They do not know the hour of the owner's birth, nor what silver-headed beast they guard. And it's there's so much, we need to stop for lunch now, but there's so much in that because that the chief is the place of origin. It's the head from which the universe arises. The silver-headed beast is in a certain sense the white stag who is Christ. These people do not know what is at the heart of the Christian revelation, which is the stag who continually dies and is continually reborn. When we went with Arthur, there was disastrous contention. Except seven, none rose up from Caer Ochrin. Now, Caer Ochrin is simultaneously the castle of the trees, which gives us this image of the ancient groves in which the Druids worked and studied. But it can also mean the castle of the keys. Acha or Ochra. Ochra is the Welsh word for open. So the Ochrin could mean the place of the opening, which is the idea of unlocking. Image from child of Acharadrus, open the door. Right, so it would suggest to them, oh, this is the opening of the door, this place, the silver-headed beast, the mysterious, there is a treasure in the Christian tradition that they do not understand. And then that takes us right back to where we started, where the monks are the choir of dogs or the choir of wolves who do not understand the nature of the Awen. So, that's a kind of...
Whistle stop,
so how to be an Awen Iddion. Right? We're obviously going to keep on coming back to it. But the whole point of it is not to get kind of lost in all the imagery, right? But actually it is describing this process that happens when we get present in our body and present and follow the breath of the Awen. It is a powerful multi-leveled mnemonic, which as you get into it more and more, you see more and more into it. But it draws on these twin themes of Christian tradition and Welsh and ancient Celtic tradition, but puts them together in a really different kind of way. And in a way, our job as we work with these things is to work with, if you like, that heritage of tradition from both places, but to work with that here and now in relationship to the dilemmas of our own life and our own time. And to see what happens when we do that. But for now, let's go for lunch.